to explore your spirit with Kayla. Journey with Kayla as she speaks with researchers, artists, teachers, and healers, delving into topics of ancient mysteries, metaphysical explorations, and new discoveries from science and spiritual arenas. Explore Your Spirit with Kayla can be found online at exploreyourspirit.com. Visit the website for more podcasts, articles, metaphysical news, and upcoming events.
Welcome to Explore Your Spirit. I'm your host, Kayla. Our guest this evening is Stephen Browdy, a professor of philosophy, past president of the Parapsychological Association, and author of 5 books, including ESP and Psychokinesis, Immortal Remains, The Evidence for Life After Death, and most recently, The Gold Leaf Lady and Other Parapsychological Investigations. Professor Browdy will be lecturing Friday, March 7th, 7:30 to 9 p.m. for the Rhine Research Center. The event will be held at the Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus. For more information and tickets, visit rhine.org. Welcome, Dr. Browdy, to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Looking so forward to speaking with you, and you have such an illustrious career, and even checking out your website, you have a list of just the few of your accomplishments on the main page that take quite a long page, and that's not even the in-depth version. So you're quite an accomplished and interesting man, I must say.
Well, it also helps that I'm an old man.
Well, I know a lot of people, regardless of their age, that don't accomplish as much, and you've certainly been busy with your investigations and are certainly well-versed in this particular topic that you'll be talking about at the Rhine. So it's very exciting for everyone there to have you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Wonderful. I have to start with your book here. It's so intriguing with the title, and of course, that's where I'd like to start, as the book is entitled The Gold Leaf Lady, and in fact, it was a lady in Florida who was able to produce gold leaf from her skin. Is that correct?
Almost. It's not. It turns out it wasn't gold. It turned out to be brass. And I believe there's an interesting story about why it wasn't gold. But in any case, the material would appear instantaneously on her at various parts of her body. People could be very close up to it while it happened. There was no doubt at all that she wasn't just concealing the foil somewhere and then placing it on her body. It would appear at close range instantaneously.
How would you describe that? Is that a materialization? What actually is going on there?
That's the million-dollar question. my guess is it's got to be classified as either an apport, where something is transported from one location to another, or a materialization. But the problem is it doesn't exactly fit into the profile of either of those phenomena from what we know from other cases. So in materializations, for example, usually things that are reported to materialize subsequently dematerialize. So if you read all the historical reports of materializations, they might coalesce out of a kind of wispy mass and then become a wispy mass again and then just dissipate. And I don't know of any other case quite like it. So I'm not exactly sure how to classify it. The only thing I can be sure about is that it's not a normal phenomenon, it's not fraud, and so it seems to be paranormal.
I'm not sure if that's more disconcerting or not, that it turned out to be brass instead of gold leaf.
Well, yeah, there's a story to tell about the psychogenesis of this, what was going on in this woman's life that may have led up to it. I mean, I think one of the most interesting questions we can ask about psychic functioning, since we really don't know its natural history, is what kind of role is it really playing out there in the world? And I think we get a clue from poltergeist cases when we see how the things that happen in standard poltergeist cases might make sense in terms of the poltergeist agent's psychology. And I think there's a story to tell about this woman as well, and that's part of what I'll be speaking about Friday.
And in this particular book, you've traveled the country from Florida to New York to California and in between researching cases. And some of them you found to be actual cases that you could not fully or further explain what was causing them. And then others as well that you found that you were able to find a regular answer.
Yeah. I mean, the whole point of the book was to cover a range of situations. I mean, some really good, paranormal phenomena. And then also to present a couple of cases that really demonstrate some other things about what it's like to be out there in the world trying to investigate the phenomena. So they're case studies, but they have various sorts of lessons to present to us, I think. I mean, whether we're trying to investigate a PK superstar who's actually trying to cheat, and also there are some lessons to be learned, I think, about how to deal with the people who hang on to prominent psychics and who sometimes get in the way and make it very difficult to investigate.
How did you start out in this business? What led you or interested you?
The story goes back to something that happened to me in graduate school, and the short version of this is that I was busy writing a dissertation on temporal logic and the philosophy of language. In those days, I fancied myself to be a kind of hard-nosed materialist. Not for any good reasons. It was just a kind of intellectual conceit I was cultivating at the time. And it was a very slow day in Northampton, Massachusetts, and a couple friends came over, and we'd seen the only movie in town, and so they said, well, let's play a game called Table Up. And what they meant was, let's have a seance. I'd never done this before. I'd never given psychic stuff any real serious thought. But for the next 3 hours in my house in broad daylight, I watched my table tilt up and down without any aid from my friends or from me, and it would spell out answers in response to questions. And frankly, it scared the hell out of me. And I really had no place to put that in my conceptual world at the time. And I also knew that if I mentioned this to any of my mentors at the university, that it would probably be professional death for me. So I literally put it out of my mind. I put it on the back burner. I got my PhD. I published, I'd like to think, some highly respectable articles in logic and the philosophy of language and the philosophy of science, got tenure. And then, with what I thought would be the security provided by tenure, I realized that if I needed really to be thinking about what happened to me back in graduate school, if I was any kind of honest philosopher and any kind of honest scholar. And I knew that some well-known philosophers had written about this and taken it seriously, and so I read what they had to say, and I decided there was something I needed to sink my teeth into. And then I realized that I was, to do a responsible job of this, I needed to become a member of the community that was actively investigating the phenomena. And that's what's happened, and the rest, I guess, is history.
It's so interesting what you mentioned there about tenure. And I've heard this story from so many researchers and scientists that it's so difficult to speak out about any experience, whether they've had a personal experience, something in their family, or something like you had with the table. Why do you think that is in the realms of science when it's open in other ways to so many otherworldly possibilities, whether it's in space or at the microscopic level? Why is it so difficult for so many people to open up to that idea of a sixth sense or beyond?
Part of it, I think, is just trying to maintain a tenuous foothold on these scholars or scientists' intellectual corner of the world. So, I mean, they think it might force them to give up everything they've held dear. I'm not sure that's true, but they think that. Then there's a more interesting reason, I think, and it's, we can see it really clearly with psychokinesis. The best way I know to explain it is, suppose I could move a matchstick a millimeter by thinking about it. It's a very small step conceptually from doing that to making somebody drop dead by thinking about it. So the existence of any PK at all forces us to take seriously a kind of magical worldview that most of us associate, usually condescendingly, only with so-called primitive cultures. It's a worldview in which thoughts can kill and have other sorts of lethal or malevolent consequences. And it's a worldview in which we might have to take responsibility for a whole range of things we just as soon be bystanders for. I mean, most people in industrialized cultures aren't very comfortable with the idea that if you have a nasty thought about somebody and that person has an accident, that we might have had something to do with that. Mm-hmm. But I think that's exactly the implication of the existence of psychokinesis, and I think it scares people to the very depths of their soul.
That's a very interesting point. And especially coming from the metaphysical standpoint, where so many people are really talking about thoughts or things and using thoughts for positive means as well,
right,
without considering that everything has a yin and a yang. So.
Exactly right. I don't know of anything that can be used only for the good.
Mm-hmm. And you've written quite a bit about PK. You had your book, ESP and Psychokinesis, Philosophical Examination, and The Limits of Influence, Psychokinesis and the Philosophy of Science. And I would assume in those two books you really explored this at that deeper level of what PK or what you found that PK can be capable of?
Mostly in The Limits of Influence. When I wrote ESP and Psychokinesis, that was my first book. I was concerned mostly with the laboratory evidence, which I think is interesting enough. And then after doing that, I realized that to be a responsible scholar in this area, I needed to read the stuff that most people, even in parapsychology, held a very dim view of, physical mediumship in particular. And the received view was that the evidence from physical mediumship was evidence collected under poor conditions of observation, and the possibility of fraud was very great, you know, yada, yada, yada. Then I read it for myself, and I realized that most of the people who were taking that view actually hadn't studied the material, that, in my view, this material was many times more impressive than the laboratory material, and much more important conceptually. And so The Limits of Influence really is about that. It's about the limits of influence and what we can conclude about the range and the scope and the refinement of PK if we take the evidence seriously for physical mediumship.
So much has been studied at the Rhine as well, 70 years of research with ESP and PK, TK, all of this type of work and the work you've done. What do you think is coming in the future? What is going to be the topic or the type of parapsychological research that's going to come in the future that really everyone wants to know about? Is it near death? Is it consciousness in its full realms? What do you see?
I wish I knew how to answer that. I can only be pretty cynical at this stage in my career about the future of parapsychological research. I mean, when I look over the history of parapsychology from the early days of the SPR, I see the same thing over and over. I mean, I see a number of serious-minded, open-minded, courageous scholars and scientists taking a careful look at it, and I see continued resistance from within the established scientific and academic communities. I see the same weak arguments trotted out over and over and over, and it's very hard looking over the history of the field to see any substantial progress. There's good evidence there for people who are willing to take a look at it, but I'm not sure I see any groundswell in progress of people who are willing to take a look at it. So I don't know what to expect for the future. I figure I'm old enough to be cynical.
Well, I think with the new generation coming in too, perhaps there'll be a resurgence in that way at
that
the younger level. Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Stephen Brody.
We'll be right back with more of Explore Your Spirit with Kayla.
Hi, this is Kayla, host of Explore Your Spirit. You're listening to a special interview for the Rhine Research Center. The Rhine Research Center is a scientific institute dedicated to the study of consciousness with a rich history and collection of research in the psi field, beginning with J.B. and Louisa Rhine and their work at Duke University from 1927 onward. Located in Durham, North Carolina, the Rhine holds public presentations on a wide variety of psi and paranormal subjects, including ghosts, psychic abilities, ESP, after-death events, collective dreams, remote viewing, energy fields and healing, psychokinesis, and much, much more. Explore Your Spirit is pleased to offer this series of interviews with researchers and scientists who work in the psi fields and participate in programs with the Rhine Research Center. These interviews will be archived in the future on the Rhine Research Center website with additional audio material, including historical footage, new conferences, and lectures on a wide variety of subjects. Become a member of the Rhine Research Center today and do your part to help research grow in the parapsychological fields. For more information about the Rhine Research Center and to become a member of this incredible scientific research organization, visit the Rhine Research Center online at www.rhine.org. That's R-H-I-N-E.org.
We're back with more of Explore Your Spirit with Kayla.
We're back from our break, speaking more with Dr. Stephen Browdy, who's going to be speaking Friday, March 7th on the Duke campus Stedman Auditorium for the Rhine Research Center about his book, The Gold Leaf Lady, who actually had a brass type of gold leaf foil, as we'll call it now, coming from her skin, and other many interesting paranormal and parapsychological investigations that he did across the country. And Stephen, getting back to talking about you and some of your work and what you've done, you were a past president of the Parapsychological Association.
Yes, that's right.
Some people know of this group and others don't. Educate us on that. What do they do?
The PA is an affiliate organization of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It's basically a professional scientific and scholarly society, not just anybody who can be a member. To be a full member of the PA, you have to have published research of some respectable kind. It's an important distinction because there are a lot of people out there who think that all you need to do to be a parapsychologist is to place your hand on a rock, look at the sky, and say, I'm a parapsychologist. It actually isn't so easy. So this is a serious organization, mostly of scientists, but people from other areas of academia, such as myself, who take the evidence seriously. There isn't a corporate opinion within the PA about which evidence is the best or which phenomena are genuine. It's what links all the members of the PA together is their desire to take an open-minded look at the evidence and figure it out for themselves.
Do you find that they are doing that as well, stepping into the 21st century, and are you still involved with them in that capacity?
Yes, I'm still involved. It's interesting. I mean, it's a small organization, and part of the problem is it's hard for people in standard academic professions to be actively involved in this because there isn't a great deal of institutional support for doing work in this area. So unless you are fortunate, like me, to have tenure, or fortunate to be working at one of the very few respectable academic institutions that are willing to at least modestly support this kind of research, you're unlikely to be able to do anything about it. So there's really only a handful of people out there who can do any kind of sustained, serious research in this area. It used to be in the U.S. there was a great deal of support from one funding agency or another. Now the center of gravity has pretty much shifted to Europe.
I think in the U.S. now there's a big acceptance of intuition or psychic ability, where a lot of people feel that beyond the research, that they see it as a normal part of their lives or in many people's lives at this point.
I'm sure that's true, and it's very sad that the academic community is so out of step with what for majority of mankind probably is an accepted fact of life. And they really ought to get with it, seems to me. But I know I'm something of a voice in the wilderness.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, so you're
on
the right show.
That.
getting back to your book for a minute, very interesting, and I'm sure any sports fans out there that would hear this would really want to pay attention. But your wife, with her experiments with astrology, and she was able to guide a professional soccer team to the top of their league. That's pretty impressive.
Several such teams, actually, in both Europe and Asia.
I would think she's going to be in high demand with that kind of
That would be nice. Potential. Since she moved to the U.S., she's been pretty much cut off from this kind of work when she first moved to be with me. She's from the former Yugoslavia.
Mm.
She was working at the time for a team in China, and several times a week the coach would call and try to get Gina's predictions on what would happen in the upcoming game. And Gina would have extremely precise predictions about who would be likely to score at what time in the game, which players should be put in, which players should be taken out. Shall I give you an example?
Yes, absolutely.
At one point, Gina had seen that the regular goalkeeper for this Chinese team was going to have a bad day, but that the reserve goalkeeper would have an extremely lucky day. Now, in professional soccer, you almost never play the reserve goalkeeper. That's just not done unless the principal goalkeeper has been injured. And so the coach didn't listen to Gina, and the team lost very badly. But Gina saw that the same situation would hold for the next two games, and she insisted that the coach follow her advice to take out the regular goalkeeper and put in the reserve goalkeeper. And in fact, when he did that, the team won both games by shutouts. Now, what interested me about this was that Gina had not seen that the reserve goalkeeper would play well. She had seen that he would have a lucky day. And in fact, as long as he was in goal, his skill was never tested. These otherwise better-funded and highly skilled teams from Shanghai and Beijing could not make a shot on goal. Everything was going high or wide. And so, in fact, he was having a very lucky day. His skill was never tested.
You know, I've studied traditional feng shui for many years, and it's so in tandem there. It works together, I guess, in tandem with feng shui, the lay of the land and the energy there, as well as Chinese astrology and bringing that all together. And it's very accepted over there that all of that has great importance and can be followed. And of course, a lot of people follow Western astrology here as well. But did she do something similar? Did she do the birth dates of every player? And did she do like the date that the team incorporated? And is
that
how she figured
out? And she had information about the players on both teams, the coaches, the judges, the officials, very important, especially since it appears that many games are fixed. And, yeah, well, that's basically what she does. And she's very good at figuring out really precise birth times. You want another example?
Yes.
Gina usually does not like to do personal horoscopes, but a friend of mine was very interested in having Gina do hers, and she knew her birth date, of course, but not her time of birth. And when Gina does a personal horoscope, she actually does a group horoscope. She needs to also do the horoscopes of significant others of this person. And especially helpful are times of death of significant others, parents, grandparents, children, whatever. And what Gina did was to take all this information and then triangulate what her time of birth must have been for all of these things to have been where they were on this person's chart. And at that point, my friend found her birth certificate, and Gina had nailed it to the minute.
That is impressive. I know a lot of astrologists. I know a lot about astrology, and that is extremely impressive.
Gina does something different than what most astrologers do. I'm not competent to describe it. I take a stab at it in the book, and for various reasons, Gina's reluctant to give out much information about what she does because she's convinced that that knowledge could be used for all sorts of insidious purposes.
That's why it was protected even back in Chinese astrology in those times, and feng shui as well, because the study of both can be used for great good or otherwise, like you mentioned.
I didn't know that, but I'm not surprised, and I'm interested to hear that.
Absolutely. Now, you talk also about your own personal experiences with synchronicity.
Yes.
And are you a believer now of synchronicity?
Well, I believe that there are meaningful coincidences. What I don't accept is the standard explanation of what synchronicities are. And the standard explanation is that somehow the universe is just speaking to us, that the universe is bringing events together in meaningful ways. And for reasons I try to go into, I actually think that literally makes no sense. I think the true story about synchronicities is that this is something we do ourselves, that and this takes us back to what I was writing about in The Limits of Influence, that I think under the right circumstances, we have the power within us to organize events to fall out in meaningful clusters for us.
Would that be in the sense that something that we really wanted and we gave a lot of thought to, we would then attract that energy and certain things to us in that way, and that would lead us to believe that they're synchronistic type events because we're using so much energy trying to attract and draw that event to us?
If we're lucky, and if conditions are right, I mean, they may not be right. The other side of that coin, of course, is that we can use it, like any kind of knowledge or ability, for self-destructive purposes as well. And for me, a clear example of the kind of thing I have in mind is people who are exceptionally unlucky. I think they would make actually great subjects for a naturalistic parapsychological study. And I don't mean people who just feel themselves to be, you know, somewhat unlucky. There really are people out there for whom almost every event is a disaster. I mean, I was actually married to a person like that once.
Oh, my.
And I lived next door to a couple, in fact, who it seemed everything they bought was defective. Electronic equipment would fail to work right out of the box. Their cars were always in the shop, even though they both had brands noted for their reliability. A solid wooden rocking chair broke in the second day they owned it with their infant son on it. And my favorite example of what happened was the wife bought a poster-sized photograph of what she thought was the Golden Gate Bridge, and she framed it and put it up on her living room wall. And I had to tell her, you know, that's not the Golden Gate Bridge. That's the Brooklyn Bridge. So here's a woman who both literally and figuratively bought the Brooklyn Bridge.
That would be an interesting story. I'm not sure how many unlucky people would like to sign up for it, but
right.
That wouldn't be interesting. We'd like to hear from anyone. If you're particularly unlucky, send us an email and we'll forward it on here to Dr. Browdy to consider.
I should also say, it's not just things we might do to ourselves. You know, just as we can make ourselves sick, I think we can make ourselves unlucky. And just as we can make ourselves well, I think we can make ourselves lucky.
Absolutely.
If we're lucky. I mean, if other conditions are right. But the other aspect to this is that it equally could be something that somebody's doing to us or for us.
Do you believe in all those types that it's a power of mental thought or persuasion? Or is there any idea that it could be something karmic? Would you enter into that thought at all, that we might have karma that follows us? Or is it all in our mind and thoughts?
I don't know what to say about karma. I mean, I have very little doubt that it's something that we can do ourselves. But I don't have a well-formed opinion about karma.
It's a bit difficult to test, isn't it?
It really is.
We can't even test everything we want to that's happening now, much less what happened perhaps
exactly
in another
right.
time. What would you like to study next, or do you have another book you're working on or another project?
Well, I'm old enough now to collect Social Security, and what I'm thinking about doing is just getting back to making more music and cutting back a little bit on research. But if I know me, I'll probably end up writing something more. I mean, I still have some stuff I want to write about the evidence for survival of death, and I'm working on an article right now. But after that, I have no idea. It'll hit me at some point.
There seems to be a lot of correlations between people who are drawn to music and are very accomplished in music that are also drawn to these types of things as well, almost like the mind is going further out and reaching into this type of discovery. And I'm going back to where we first began with the table moving and the seance that you were into and the experiences. Do you think you were an active participant in that experience or just an observer?
There's no way to know. I mean, one of the really nifty things about the evidence for PK sitter groups is that it seems to work very effectively in groups. And I think that takes us back to what I said was scary about PK, because if you're with a group and you're getting large-scale observable phenomena, it's very easy to disavow your responsibility for what's going on. So you can always say, well, somebody else did it, not me. And so it becomes a lot less scary that way. So I don't know. I mean, it may have had something to do with me. It may have been something unique about the interaction between my friends and me. Or it may be that my friends who had a very volatile marriage were just putting all their energy into the table.
And, of course, we do find that a lot in PK, where there's some type of emotional upset, volatility, sometimes, I guess, a lot really with children that are going through puberty as well or in their teen years and other people as well. That seems to follow in that vein, have you found?
Yes, that's the profile of a standard poltergeist case. And I'll say that some of the most interesting subjects that I've studied personally have been people who are in difficult relationships, usually marriages.
Fascinating, as always. Again, this is Dr. Stephen Browdy, who's going to be speaking for the Ryan Research Center at Duke campus on Stedman Auditorium this Friday, March 7th. Hear about this and much, much more that he has to talk about. The Gold Leaf Lady, people that left images transferred from photographs onto other objects onto their body. A deceased Chicago elevator operator who could make a variety of things appear on Polaroid film. And many, many other experiments, scientific beliefs, and fascinating details about cases that he followed all across the country. He's got so much to share. Please come out and join us and learn more about this fascinating subject. Dr. Browdy, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Explore Your Spirit is on the web. Visit us at exploreyourspirit.com.